Thank you. In fact, there are two ways you can read the title. I'll explain that as well. I'll write it here. So for the first little bit of the talk, I'll try to draw on the difference between classical information and quantum information. Later on, we'll move on to the main topic, which is quantum information theory here. The two ways you can pass this. The first one, which is the first half of the talk, will be on the theory of dealing with quantum information. Then we'll move on to a slightly more specific topic within that area, which deals with quantum version of information theory, specifically concerning channel capacities and so on. So there's a broader subject of quantum information theory versus quantum information theory. We tried to do both, but the stack is pretty thick here. I'm a little concerned. So now, what do we care in this field? It's something that I would also like to clarify, because throughout the talk, I'll be very sketchy in the ideas and so on. But we really care about proving things in this field. So the question we address most of the time is, what can or cannot be done? With quantum mechanics. Now here, when we talk about quantum mechanics, we're talking about the five axioms of quantum mechanics and nothing else. It's purely abstract. We talk about, so the theory of quantum mechanics give us a definition of what it is to be able to encode information, what are states, what we can do to transform the states, and that's it, how we can make measurement and extract information. So that's all we have in our theory. We don't deal with, like, so I'll clarify here that, not dealing with the actual realization. So we take the fun bit of the job. We just talk and do the math. And we don't build anything. And we don't even care how things appear in some sense. Of course we do, but it's someone else's problem. For example, whether it is an electron or a photon, it doesn't matter to us. We only write 0 or 1. That's all. We don't care whether it is an optical fiber or the satellite or anything that transmits the data. It is a quantum channel to us. We just draw the line as a channel. Similarly, a gate is a gate. We write down what the gate does. But whether it's actually done by the James Comyn coupling or the star effect, again, it is not in our immediate concern. We care, but it's not our job, basically. Now, what is our job? This is also important. Is that we need very precise and quantitative statements. That can be proved. In fact, a lot of us started out in theoretical physics and eventually evolved to become a mathematical physicist that seemed to be overly concerned about proving down to the epsilon delta of everything. Now, there's a reason for that to happen, because over and over again, half of what we guess is correct turned out to be not true. It's actually really the case, and so we learn to be cautious in the end, and until we prove something or otherwise, or disprove something, usually with a kind of example, we try to stay relatively cautious. And that's why we actually prove almost everything that we'll be dealing with. Now, I'll focus on this talk, they're all carefully, heavily proven over the last 13 years. I was here 13 years ago as a student. But I will state the no epsilon, no delta version as much as possible. And it looks very sketchy, but the fact is that they all have been proven. I'll emphasize that point. So I'll go through a little bit of vocab first. A lot of you probably know this, so it's a good time for eating. one bit is the ability to being able to prepare. It's just the ability to prepare two distinguishable states. Usually we write that as 0 and 1. By the way, it's a big advantage over zero and, for 0 and 1 over up and down, because it takes only one stroke. Now, if we have D states, D distinguishable states in our system, it corresponds to log. Log is usually base 2 here. T log D bits of information. This is clear when you think about D as being 2 to the n. When you have n symbols, either 0 or 1, you have 2 to the n possibilities. Now we have a random variable, say capitalized x, that can take d values. And we'll think about the probability. We usually write this way, probability. The random variable taking value, small x, and say d p of x. So p of x is just the probability of this happening, and the entropy of the random variable x, we usually write it as h of x, is equal to the sum of all the possible values, px log px. And now this is negative, so we have a big negative sign in front. Now this well, we like entropy, because I'll just say it in words without writing it down. When we have n independent draws of these random variables, when n is large, the outcome has to be heavily concentrated. Not all possible outcomes will show up equally likely. So when we look at the likely outcomes, group them together, they're roughly 2 to the n entropy of x of n, roughly speaking. The other outcomes almost never occur. So roughly speaking, if we want to record the outcome of n draws of x, we only need roughly n times the entropy of x number of bits. And that's why it makes it a useful notion to quantify how much information is carried in this random variable. When we go to the large number of copy limit. Now this is the first time we see this very funny phenomenon. This thing is written down, defined for one draw, but it is an asymptotic concept that involves many, many copies. Very strange thing, but it's nice because it's manageable. You can calculate these things. We'll see that we don't have this much luck later on.
So your talk is conveying some information, as I would usually call it. What's the random variable and what are the probabilities?
Ah, so you're asking how wimpy I am. So I can probably talk about, in fact, I have a big stack of papers here. I may not talk about all of this, and I will change my, depending on the time and the interest and so on, I would change my mind what to talk about. So each of these page will be on the board with some probability. So what's the random variable here is really what the symbol on the board. English is a little uncompressed, but I think it's only it's not log 26 for per alphabet. It's a little lower than that. Now this is entropy. Entropy is, in some sense, it tells us how much a random variable is conveying, but entropy is more like something that is quantifying how much we don't know by not having it. The other notion is mutual information. So when we have two random variables, x and y, and when we draw, when we write x, y together, we need a joint distribution. Now these are regularly, usually, heavily correlated. Then we write down the mutual information as the symbol is the I, the big I, x colon y. Now these are all clearly defined once you have a joint distribution on x and y together. So what you can think about this is, this part is something like the entropy of the random variable x when you actually know y, with a minus sign in the front. Sorry about this. And so this mission information tells you how much less you are ignorant about x if you know y. And so it has a good meaning of the information carried in y about x. But it is neutral, it's symmetric. The two random variables here is actually symmetric. So. Now with all this background, we can start to talk about quantum information. Another little bit of notation. Now in the quantum setting, qubit instead of a bit is a vector in two-dimensional complex qubit space. Now everyone knows what a vector is. We usually, in school, we sometimes write a vector as just we list the coordinates. But throughout the entire field of quantum information, we write a vector of this type, kind of loud, in a way that we call the cat, and then the first coordinate shows here. We give a symbol to the first basis, usually 0 plus 1. So these are the two chosen coordinates when we use a qubit. And we write it explicitly as a linear combination. So, give you a chance to think this conversion. Now, when we have more than two dimensions, say when we have four dimensions, I'll give one more example. A vector of this type implicitly with basis 0, 0 first, 0, 1. 1, 0 and 1, 1. It's usually written like this. And implicitly, we want to use this basis to denote the fact that there are two dimensions in one qubit space and two dimensions in the other qubit space. And we take tensor product of the two things together. So I hope these are familiar enough with the Cohen-Tanuji style of quantum mechanics. They don't teach this in some quantum mechanics books for some reason. And so this notion of how much information is in a random variable, it carries through in the quantum setting quite well. We can do data compression just the way we would do it in classical data. So that's not very different. So if it's not too exciting, I'm not going into detail with that. Now I will start to describe a scenario again in which two parties, Alice and Bob, will play. And I'll use that setting a few times in the talk, so I'll clean up the board and explain that. One of the parties, she always initiates the process. That's why she has the alphabet A there. She picks a quantum state phi x. X is a classical random variable with probability px. So somehow she decides, maybe using a coin toss or depending on the weather, depending on her mood. And then depending on that, she picks a quantum state. Now this state lives in D dimension. And there may be n possibilities. We haven't specified what n is. N can be very, very large. It can be infinitely many. And then what she does after she decided on the state is that she prepares it. System A in state psi x. So she knows about what state she has prepared. She prepared in a physical system. like if you like to think about it as a spin, whatever. And then she gives that system. Now Bob doesn't know what psi x is, but he has the system A now. The question is, what can Bob do to the system? So the most general thing we know is that he can pick this state. He doesn't know what x is, so we just put a question mark here. These are quantum circuits. We usually draw time goes from left to right. This straight line going that way, these are quantum wires. These are just the quantum state traversing in time. And he can fit it to, usually what we call these quantum circuits. Everything in quantum mechanics is unitary, so these are just unitary evolution. He can attach extra ancilla if he wants. He can make measurement inside, but he does not need to really make the measurement. He can condition everything quantumly. So without loss of generality, a big part of this is actually unitary. And then in the very end, he makes some measurement and extract some outcome, some random variable y. So the random variable is y, but the outcome, specific outcome, will be denoted by small y. So he learns something from the state by means of a measurement. And for now, we assume that he also has the left behind system A. So in physics, we call this a non-demolition measurement on the state. And now what we want to find out is, so what we want to understand is how much he can learn here, and then what will happen to the state thereafter. Yes?
Just clarification. Psi of x varies continuously, or is it a discrete?
You can choose to think about it either way.
It's a vector in d-dimensional space.
In d-dimensional space. So Alice, in principle, can choose it uniformly according to the Hall measure. It can be a continuous random variable. It may be easier.
P of x is a distribution, density distribution.
Yeah, you can think about it as a density. But for almost all purposes, you can think about it as just being a discrete distribution. You can take it as large as exponential in D. Yeah, because if you have a set of state that's exponential in the dimension, then every other state in the continuous spectrum, in the continuous Hilbert space, is very, very close to one of those. Then the rest of the thing will go through, pretty much. So now the first, finally we get to some results. The first theorem here, quantum only, says that if now this is a very crude way to say it. What I want to say is that if your measurement, the measurement outcome here, extract any information about what this state is, you no longer have that state. You lose information on that state. And the actual situation is worse. It makes the state less distinguishable. You lose, the quantum system has less when you try to get information out in the classical measurement outcome. And that's generally a very irreversible process, very wasteful process, as we'll see in the third example here later on. This is the first theorem concerning what happens when you extract information from a quantum system. Now there are many versions of this. The first one might be the no-cloning theorem in 82, and then it was refined. The new one back just 2 years ago on describing what happened as a mapping from here to there in terms of how much information or how noisy this channel is from the state to the classical random variable. If this is noisy, then this part will be nearly identity and vice versa. So there are many forms of this theorem. But the important thing to remember is that if you extract information from an unknown quantum state, and these turn out to be not orthogonal to one another, then you disturb the state in general. The classical situation in which we can extract information without disturbing it is a very special case of this picture in which these happen to be mutually orthogonal. And except for that situation, this generically hold. Now, because of this, clearly, I won't write on the board. We have the no-cloning theorem popping out right away. If we can clone, you take one of these, it gives you one, I'll just write on the button. I have to see what's doing. The cloning theory, if you can clone, you take one copy of that, and you get two copies. Then you measure this in a way to extract some information. You can just do whatever measurement you want and gain at least some information here. And you still have a perfect copy here, which is a contradiction to what we just saw in the theorem. So the no-cloning theorem is a very crude way to describe the situation. But it's probably the first one that was noted, or maybe it basically comes from uncertain principle, depends on how you want to give the credit, and so I won't try to do that. So that's no cloning. And now I'll just say in word what else you can use it for the next one. In 69, 68, 70, I don't know which year it was because it's unpublished, Steve Wisner was considering the situation like this and decided that quantum state would be a good way to make money because no one can clone it. It sounds almost obvious. It's not so obvious. Incidentally, for money to work, you have to verify. So the cleverness in that construction is the way that if you don't, you're not the bank, you're not the legitimate user, you can't clone it. But if you're either the user or the bank, you have some extra information about, say, Alice here knows everything about the state. So the bank does. So the bank has more power than other illegitimate parties around to verify that these are valid money. And so that's the first, I think that may be the first application of quantum information in information technology. And it was unpublished and it was hidden away. But eventually it evolved to quantum key distribution that was made known in 84. Now, I'll just write a few words about quantum key distribution here. The first one was proposed by Brennan and Broussard in 84. Yes?
So you knew about the no-cloning theorem before the no-cloning theorem?
I think he knows it more than that statement. Yeah. Because I think the quantum money idea has a lot more in it. It's recorded, but I think that's correct. So then the next application.
Well, I mean, the no-cloning theorem must go back much, at least implicitly, much, you know, further, you know, in the early days of quantum mechanics.
Yeah, because of the uncertainty principle, if you're in clone, there's no uncertainty left behind.
Also, I think, doesn't cloning imply faster than light communication?
That I don't know.
Yeah,
good that there are a lot of people who know this around. I almost think that I don't need the notes. So now let's take a look at QPD. It's a fun application of what we have just been the only. Oops.
X is a classical.
Yes.
Very,
yes.
You have two kinds of probabilities working here, and yeah. You don't have a single system state, but you have a collection of states for each value of X.
Very good. This is actually a good point. Thank you. What happened is that you can think about this as an X here. We really write the X out. Alice, so this end up going to Bob. This is Bob's. This was with Bob for a while, and then he chose to have these two things in the end. Alice sent this thing to Bob. What Alice has is the record of X. Yeah, it is actually a bipartite system in which Alice has a classical register holding X, and she holds onto it. It's actually a very crucial point. Recently, this is the reason why we believe that you cannot use coarse timeline curve to speed up computation. because Alice is holding this thing. But this is a side remark. But it is true that, yes, it's properly a bipartite system in which Alice really hold on to the information, classical information here. And it's a huge register. And Bob has a very small quantum system in general. I should pause and see if there are questions before explaining how quantum key distribution works.
Maybe just a comment in terms of the classical probability. If before the picture at the end, before Bob does the measurement, if you after he's done these other things to it, if you take the combined state and you trace out Bob's system, you get the density matrix that you get is essentially a classical probability distribution in some sense. Trace over, so, I mean, Bob is going to do a measurement in some orthonormal basis, okay? And that's going, I mean, before he does that, he's got this correlated system. So before he does the measurement, you trace out Bob's system and only look at Alice's system. Alice's system is now represented by a mixed state. And the different, you know, it's not just one psi-x, it's different psi-x's. And in that density matrix, the probabilities that are the eigenvalues in that density matrix are in the y basis, are essentially classical with respect to that particular distribution that you get by looking at it.
Yeah, so the crucial thing is that y here is a classical random variable that you extract out from a quantum system. Before that, everything is just these are quantum systems, and then we don't talk about classical mutual information. It's this classical random variable. There are other notions of entropy that we need to deal with later.
Everything until you made the clarifying remark. About the state x, you know, the dot there.
Uh-huh.
What is this state? Is this the same as psi x or is it different?
It's different because, for example, I can take n to be 2 to the d. So I would need to have 2 to the d values here. And psi x lives in a d-dimensional Hilbert space.
So what is x?
X is the identity of the quantum state. For example, I can choose to send, now D is 0, D is 2. Alice want to prepare A0 plus B1 for a whole lot of possibilities of A and B. Then the whole array of A and B will form X.
Actually, you can make it more dramatic and say that X is infinite.
Infinity, yeah, it's continuum. Yeah. But the point here is that there's a lot more in X than in the state itself. And in fact, this is what exactly I'll get into after I get through QKD. But or I should just skip quantum key distribution. First of all, here.
The thing about the key distribution is if you try to read the key, you can't read the changes.
Yeah, pretty much. So that's good. You get through that, and it works. It works even if your channel is noisy. It works even if the eavesdropper is trying to attack all the transmission at once. We deal with the most powerful attack by an eavesdropper allowed by quantum mechanics. The eavesdropper can keep the quantum state until much later and measure it, and your quantum key distribution is still secure. We can even do quantum key distribution over a noisy quantum channel, so noisy that you cannot send noiseless quantum data over with coding and so on. When quantum error correcting code fails to work on the quantum channel, we can still do quantum key distribution. That's a very late result in 2006. So that's the fun part about quantum key distribution. Maribel doesn't like it. these quantum channels are noisy, but they send quantum states. And the way it's noisy is such that you cannot do error correcting code to send in a smaller amount of quantum data. That is pretty much intact. We'll get into quantum capacity in 10 minutes' time.
Identify as classical variable, why?
We haven't specified. He will choose what to measure, depending on his goal. This is another very crucial thing, because depending on what he measures, his random variable, y, has very different features, and it will have different influence here. We see the examples. Yes. Even if it's not here, I'm being fair. So this is theorem one. So QKD, we get through that, and then we do theorem two. So when we max over all the possibilities here, so we just don't write down what we're maximizing over, basically what Bob can do, we maximize over that. The mutual information between X and Y is no bigger than, we call this accessible information. It's no bigger than a fairly complex quantity called the collateral information, which in turn is clearly no bigger than log D. For those who know what it is, I'll just write it once. Now the entropy on the on the eigenvalue of the matrix here. This matrix is a convex combination of projectors onto these states. Now in the general case, this may not even be pure. This can be just mixed state given by density matrices. Then we just mix up the density matrices and call it an average state. And we look at the entropy, the von Neumann entropy, which is the entropy of the eigenvalues of that matrix. We look at the entropy of the mixture of the matrix minus the average entropy of these. Now, in this case, this is zero. Pure state has zero von Neumann entropy. But again, we can replace this phi x by some kind of density matrix. And this is called the Hohlevel bound. The crucial thing is that it's no bigger than log D. And x is huge. X has a lot of information in general. But you can extract very little out of it.
Make a comment?
If you're using qubits and b is 2 to the n, then that will be n. That will be log b will be n. And what it's saying is that in the beginning you have this continuum that you can use to encode psi of x. So you can encode much, much more information than you could classically, manipulate it in lots of ways. But at the end of the day, when Bob does the measurement, information that can be extracted is no more than can be extracted classically.
Yeah, you can think about it as a third irreversible process to prepare a state. Yeah, unless we make sure that Alice hold on to this register, telling her what state it is. Now, the next example will be fun to see after you notice this. I want to keep this board still, so I'll erase these two theorems. So this was found in 2003. The same setting here. I should add one word about the Hohlevel bound. Hohlevel bound was calculated without concern about what's left behind. You only want to maximize the information. Now you don't even care about disturbing. You don't care about what's left behind. Now, what happened is that you can imagine the same setting. Now, after Bob has received the state, system A. If Alice sent him one extra bit, what do you think can happen to this mutual information between X and Y? Those you know, keep it to yourself for now. This is one of the examples in which we have one guess. If she sent one bit, You can't increase mutual information between two parties by more than one or two or a few bits. We're wrong. It can be as big as anything you want, depending on how you construct the problem. So I'll give one example here. So I will ask the question, I forget to write it down. How much can IX increase? So answer, unbounded. Depends on D. So the example we have is...
Sorry, the extra bit, does it depend on Y? In other words, does Alice know what Bob measured?
He doesn't. But the point is that the fit is defined with respect to the best measurement that Bob can perform. So when Alice is sending him one extra bit, he should not make the measurement before receiving it. Does it help to guess what the example may be?
Two bit system. If D were two, mm-hmm. and you first got one, and then you sent another, you would...
The point is, as information theorists, we take advantage of anything we can change in the problem to get our result. Here, the idea is that we want to play with D. I'll write down the states. Consider two D states. So we can take U as the Fourier transform, the regular Fourier transform on D-dimensional system, and consider two D states. These D form one basis, these form another, conjugate to the first one. And they're 2D state total. The thing that Alice may send to Bob is a uniform, like she just choose one of these 2D things uniformly, send it to Bob. Now, it's possible to show that before, if Bob only have that D-dimensional system, he can get at most, this is not easily proved, but someone else did the hard work for us, half log D. Now, if Alice can send one extra bit to Bob, what she should tell Bob is whether it is in this basis or in the conjugate basis. And then Bob just make a complete measurement and get the log D bits of information out. So this is without the extra bit. And with the other one, it goes up to log D. So the difference is half log D. So the difference is half log D, and D is anything we choose. So, I mean, this is quite open in the end because we find other examples in which you can, the difference is not half log D, but most of log D. There are many ways you can play with this this kind of result. But it's kind of a exemplified demonstration of the uncertainty principle. It's strange. But we know that it's true because we prove it. So that's a good thing about proving things.
I of X and Y is defined in a certain basis, is that right? I mean, it's not basis independent.
It is in the computation basis, that's what we call it. It is something that's supported by classical mechanics. The voltage being high, low, and so on.
That's strange, because if one, one could set up a basis in which you only get one, if you sort of know. Somehow the trick seems to be, I thought that
the accessible information is basis.
Yeah.
Information is basis.
Aaron?
Only on Alice's side, right? I mean, isn't the idea that you get to maximize over Bob's measurement?
Yeah.
So, in that sense, rotating Bob's system first wouldn't change it?
So now I have to make a decision, either to keep teleportation on the schedule or I should move on to talk about error correction and channel coding theorems. You have all heard about teleportation. Teleportation. So perhaps I'll just say in 2 minutes in words what it does. Despite all the science fiction description of it, it is kindergarten linear algebra. It's no more than just adding and subtracting terms in your Hilbert space. What it does, however, is to take entanglement. Entanglement is, I missed the chance to describe entanglement then. Say Alice and Bob are set to share entanglement if they have copies of this 0, 0 plus 1 non state. It does a lot of things for them. So, what is? So, if Alice and Bob have a quantum state like this in 4-dimensional Hilbert space, but they each hold 2-dimensional quantum system, then we say that they share one EDR pair. And you can make many copies of this. Or if they share things like this, when these are not equal, then they share less entanglement. But when you have many copies of this, you can convert it to many copies of that and vice versa, preserving roughly the amount of entanglement. So entanglement is something that's useful. Now, what teleportation does is that it takes this correlation that should not transmit any data for you. It's just a correlation, it's static. Combine it with classical communication, it will allow you to send quantum data. It's a lot less sexy than people talk about it, and it seems to be a misnomer of the word teleportation. If you know what it is no less surprising. It's as deep as it is obvious. It's not in conflict with one another. But this is what it does. For those who want to know about it, I can explain it sometime. I'm here for the entire program until early December, so you can ask me anytime in the hallway. Now, then I can start to erase some of this. Talk about error correction. So now I remember the biggest thing that happened 13 years ago in this program is error correction and fault tolerance. Now, when we talk about, Wim gave the talk on quantum algorithms, so that's the big motivation of the entire field in quantum information science. It is crucial to understand what noise can do to your quantum system, and we need to correct for this noise. For a while, it's not even considered to be possible to correct error in the quantum system for a few reasons. First, you can't clone your quantum state. You lose it and you lose it. Think about the person running the computation as being Bob. Someone already passed him the state, or he prepares the state a long time ago. If you make a mistake in the middle of a computation, you don't want to start from step zero. So this is one difficulty when you cannot clone quantum data. It looks like error correction will be very difficult to perform. Second, as you can see, that there are infinitely many ways to manipulate your quantum system because there are infinitely many quantum states in your Hilbert space. So how do we even identify the error as in the classical setting when you have infinitely many of them? I think the fact that we can do error correction is quite an amazing thing. It turns out that it is possible. The idea is that we should not, we don't think about error correction as copying your data. I'll see if I have time to explain what it really does. And the fact is that we should not measure what the state is. We should measure what the error is and revert the error without measuring the quantum state itself. The most surprising part was even when your encoding, decoding operation and measurement and so on are slightly faulty, you still achieve a little error reduction by using error correction. And so if you do it many times, you actually gain enough to be able to do photon quantum computation and so on. Slightly faulty means 10 to the power minus 3, 10 to the power minus 4 type of error. It's not 2-3%, but it is a finite number. So these are all quite surprising. Here, in communication set, we're mostly concerned about having a noisy quantum channel and how much data we can send through nearly noiselessly. We allow a vanishing amount of error. So I'll give a classical example first. So this is capacity. classical data and classical channels. The intuition actually carried in, so I would use a simpler example. So what this channel does is that it takes your bit, either 0 or 1, the noisy channel labeled by N, and the outcome will be P with probability 1 minus P, and it will be the inverse of B with probability P. You can think of it as not B, sigma X adding on it, a bit flip. Basically, it flip your bit with probability P per use. The crucial thing is that these are independent channels. Each use is independent from the previous one, memoryless. And then the question is, how can we send data through this channel almost reliably when we're given batch processing as many users as you want? But now, if we're given N users, we want to send a certain number of bits that is proportional to the N. Say we can send N over 3 bits, then we say that the capacity is 1/3. Because we're given more and more users, so we want to divide by the number of users we use to calculate how much data we can send per use. And we demand that the error decreases, it should vanish with the number of users we have. The error on the entire bit string, not on just one bit or the other. So that's what we call a capacity. Now, in this case, it actually sounds really asking a lot, but it's very easy to do. As it turns out, due to the channel bound, the probability that you have more than N times P errors is no bigger than the power. I shouldn't say what delta is. I should say P plus delta times N errors is no bigger than this. It basically exponentially falls off at N. You have no way to get too many errors because of the law of large numbers. So your coding strategy is just to look at the entire space of 2 to the N bit strings. So the 2 to the N bit strings. Look at any one point here, x1 through xn, and find out how big a mass it can get to after the error has acted on it. Which means that we look at the whole set when we add the possible bit. Now this bit will be 0 when you have no bit flip error on that bit. It will be a 1 when you have a bit flip. After the error, you end up with a set of possible states. How many states can there be in this circle here? How many bit strings can we have which has n times p1s and n times 1 minus p0s? The size here is 2 to the n h of the random variable p. We usually write it this way. It's the random variable that is 0 with probability 1 minus p, and with that is outcome is 1 when probability is p. So the coding strategy consists of just picking random points on your n bit space, and you pick roughly 2 to the n divided by 2 to the n hp number of random points, and call them your cowords. With high probability, even with the error, blowing that up into a big balloon, the balloons don't overlap with one another, they don't even touch one another. The trick is to choose a little less. Just a little less. Then they exponentially shrink a little bit, and then they don't touch one another anymore. Then you decode by just looking at which balloon it falls to, your output falls to, and then it's your channel's noisy channel coding theorem. It's very general. You can apply the same idea to any noisy channel, any number of output, anything. The only thing is that it has to be memoryless and users. Now there are very important thing about this result that I should mention on the board. And then we see what's going on with the quantum setting. velocity of this noisy channel has an expression that's almost too good to be true. You maximize over the input probability distribution. Look at the mutual information between the input and the output probability distribution. And that's it. So you have the input variable, x going into the channel, the y coming out. We call this the random variable y. And that's it. Now, it's very suspicious. We need n users, n very large, to do the coding. This expression has one use of the channel. It's one copy of the input distribution and one copy of the output distribution. But it is true. Now, how is it proved? You show that this is at least, the capacity has to be at least this much because we have a good code to do it, the one that you just saw. And then you do an opposite thing by proving that you can't do better than this. It's a totally separate proof called a converse. You can't, if you can't do better than this and you know that you can do this, then it has to be equal. Despite the fact that it doesn't look plausible. If you prove it, it is true. How much time do I still have? Okay. Now, so I'll just say in words what happened in the quantum setting. The idea to pick random code words is almost the same in the quantum setting. We pick a random subspace, to be space, and this is exactly how we should do quantum channel coding here in the quantum setting. It also, we have expressions similar to this. They make a lot of sense. We can find code that will do the job for us. The error vanishes with the number of users. The only thing is that we cannot prove that this is the best we can do. And in 96, there's a paper by, I believe the first one was by Shaw and Smolin, and later there's an additional name, DiVincenzo, on it. That talks about the fact that you can do better. They show that you can do better and get the capacity to be slightly higher up. So it ruined all the hope to have a simple description of what the capacity should be. Now this is to send quantum data through quantum channel. You can talk about sending classical data through quantum channel. And that's yet another expression that has been written down, proved to be doable by a good code. And it was there for 12 years before Matt Hastings proved that, again, you can do slightly better. So this is kind of the newest development. Now I have about 7-8 minutes. I'll say a few other things. Channel capacities. One funny thing about channel capacity, quantum channel capacity, so there's very many of them. You can think about sending different things to the quantum channel and calculate a capacity. You can think about giving auxiliary free resources to the parties. Very often, these are useful things to think about and tell us something about quantum information. It may not be exactly well-motivated operationally, but we can think about sending quantum data using the channel on its own. We put a zero here because you don't give any other helpful resource to the two parties. You can think about giving free classical forward communication to the party. Now it's classical, so it should not help your quantum data transmission. And indeed, this was proved back in 96. Fairly non-trivial. It turns out to be the same as the amount of entanglement, the number of e-bits you can create using the channel per use, given free forward communication. For those who know it, if you can send quantum data, you can establish EPR pairs, and vice versa because of teleportation. Now, this has to be at least as big as the entanglement capacity without free forward causal communication. Because this is for free, so this can only be better. So this is also true. But if you can send quantum data, you can establish entanglement. So this has to be bigger than Q0. So these are all the same. The other stuff, if we give really bad communication, it is known that at least it has to be better than this. But in general, there are channels in which you can do better with bad communication. Bad free cost of communication.
Why don't you use a bathroom terrible?
So third good question. It was some version of the nukes. To make it worse, if you have two way, forward and backward, free cost of communication, I'll put the two here instead of a double arrow. And it took us 12 years to prove that this can be strictly better than that for some channels. And we haven't really finished the proof. This is the same as how much entanglement you can create given free two-way cost of communication. This is in general different from that. And I have no idea if anyone has looked into that. I suspect that these two objects can be quite incomparable. The entanglement you can create given free back communication. Now, with a fairly difficult argument that I have not loaded in my head, this is bigger if you give them free entanglement and you want them to send quantum data. But this turns out to be the same if you give them both free entanglement and free back communication. Classically, if you have classical channel and classical data, back communication doesn't help. Free-forward communication, you don't want to give it in the problem. And so some of these are fairly surprising. Now, what about sending classical data through quantum channels? So once again, we have the first one without free communication. And again, free back communication to send classical data with quantum channel can be useful. In fact, there is an example in which this is 2 and this is log B for any B you want. So the difference can be big. And we don't want to give them free forward communication here, so we don't consider that problem. And we don't want to do C2 because we don't want to give free two-way communication when we talk about sending forward classical data. So the next one is give them free entanglement and see what they can do in sending classical data. This turns out, this is bigger than equal to that. And it turns out these two are related to one another. This is always half of that because of teleportation. If you can send quantum data, you have free entanglement. You always do superdense coding. You can always do superdense coding to send classical data. And vice versa, if you can send classical data, you have free entanglement. You can always do teleportation to send quantum data. So the two are tightly related. There's no freedom at all. This then has to be the same as this. There's no choice. So why am I drawing this chart? This object is sweet and nice. It has an expression that exactly has one use of the channel. You can show that you can do it. You can't do better. Everything is well understood. It also has a very nice feature that I didn't explain earlier, that if you have a noisy channel, you can use it to send data noiselessly. And if you have a noiseless channel, you can use it to simulate a noisy channel. And the conversion, Martin wondered why anyone would like to do that. And you can do the simulation with exactly the capacity of the channel, with that much of noiseless data, which means that in conversion from noisy channel to noiseless one, and vice versa, is reversible. The reason why we want to know this is then you can simulate a noisy channel using another noisy channel by first simulating the noiseless one, and then use the noiseless one to simulate the noisy one. So everything becomes the same classically. There's only one parameter, the capacity. The same here. If you have free entanglement in the form, not just EPR pairs, but in a way that is very, you have to ask for the most general entangled state for this purpose. Interconversion of quantum channel is actually possible in a way that is reversible. We really like this situation. Down here, we know that this is pretty hard to deal with at this point. This is also very hard to deal with. And a year and a half ago, it was found about something about this that I'll just write here. You can have two channels, N1 and N2, such that neither one of them has any quantum capacity. It means that you can pick as many users of first channel. It does nothing in terms of sending any quantum data noiselessly. You can't send even one qubit using as many users of that channel as you want. If you want it to be relatively close to not having any error, similar with the other channel. But what happens is that if you put them together, just one use, you can get something on the order log D or divide by half if you want to, and D is your choice. Pretty crazy. That's result by the one I just described was by John Smolin and Graham Smith. But the first time this effect has been seen is by John Yard and Graham Smith. Graham Smith should be arriving later today. And so for those who are interested in why this can be true and so on and so forth, I have two patients here that I can talk to you anytime around here on the blackboard. So thank you very much.
So you said at the beginning you're not interested particularly in the hardware. But part of what you're trying to learn here, simplify the requirements of the hardware. For example, with these EPR pairs, it looks like you can replace a lot of the would-be quantum computer capacity.
That's right. I mean, that was partly an exaggeration. Definitely, the study of these things, like such as a chart like this, will tell us what we need and what is actually useless. Don't even bother. We actually do study physical models of noise, like the Gaussian channel and so on, or the amplitude damping polarizing channel. We study specific abstract notion of a channel. We don't talk about whether it is actually a photon or an electron spin and so on, because we will not be able to capture all the physics in the calculation. And so all we can do is to have simpler model of the actual physics and try to infer some information out of it. With the advantage that when the physics, the actual implementation change a little bit, the essence of what we have found should follow still. So that's the idea. We actually do care about actual implementation and so on. But it's kind of the difference between the primary concern and a secondary concern.
Any other questions? Thank everyone.
Hello.